Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Earlier this year, Governor Tom Wolf proposed a plan to address Pennsylvania's infrastructure needs. It's called Restore Pennsylvania and would devote money toward disasters like floods, expansion of broadband internet service, clean up blighted properties and brownfields, decontaminate structures and waterways with lead, and help maintain local roadways. Under the governor's plan, the $4.5 billion project would be paid for with a severance tax on natural gas drilled in Pennsylvania. Governor Wolf is with us today to talk about Restore Pennsylvania. Governor, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. It's good to be with you, as always.
How did Restore Pennsylvania come to be? How was it developed?
Well, actually, what happened was every year it seemed I was, more recently, going out to places all around Pennsylvania to see flood damage and look at and talk to people about the consequences of flooding. Western Pennsylvania, Bradford County, Schuylkill County, York County, Philadelphia County. And each one of these things, you know, you'd look at the pain and anguish on the faces of people who had lost everything. And I felt so helpless. You'd say, I'm sorry for your loss. There's really nothing I could do. I mean, York County was the worst. My neighboring township had, I think, about $16 million worth of damage. And I think it takes $18 million as the threshold for federal support. So here's $16 million of damage that somebody has to clean up and fix up homes and roads and bridges. And that's $16 million that a township doesn't have, just lying around. I've visited places where there's no access to broadband. Where you try to use this, you can't even use your cell phone. This is in Pennsylvania in the 21st century. Been in schools where lead paint is peeling from the ceilings, where you have problems of asbestos and mold. Every city, every older municipality in Pennsylvania is struggling with problems of blight. And there are all kinds of great ideas at the local levels to what to do, how to prevent flooding. How to do something about blight, how to do something about lead paint, how to do something about broadband. There are all kinds of ideas. What they don't have is money. And so I thought, well, Pennsylvania is the only state in the union without a severance tax. We have this great natural resource. We're smack dab in the middle of the market, something that no other place in the world is. And they all have severance tax, which means, by the way, that all of us in Pennsylvania are paying a severance tax. We just pay it to out of state. We pay it to places that have it, and we're paying for their roads and bridges and schools and broadband, and no one's paying for ours. Okay. So I figured if we could do this and have a reasonable severance tax that would help make everybody a winner from this natural resource that we have in Pennsylvania, that we could actually do the things we need to do to prevent the flooding that goes on, to actually bring broadband, to stop lead paint peeling off the ceilings, to get rid of it in our schools. Think of what that would mean for a better Pennsylvania.
Everyone, Democrat, Republican, Independent, agrees the state's infrastructure needs to be modernized and upgraded. But how to pay for it is where there is a divergence of opinion. You've proposed the first 5 years in office using money, imposing a severance tax on natural gas drillers, and Republicans, which are in the majority in both the House and Senate, have said no. What's different this time?
Well, this time I think in the past it was always part of the budget, and so there might have been some concern that this would be folded into the general fund and just become a ratchet up of spending that the government has a reputation for doing. So what I did this time is say, okay, let's separate this from the budget. And let's say, no, these funds are to be used for things that are special importance to folks at the local level. You know what you need, what affects you most. And it's different in every place, but it's big and it's important. And if we were to say, okay, I keep joking that the thing that local governments hate most is hearing from Harrisburg, here's an unfunded mandate. Well, here's a funded non-mandate. This is not a mandate to do anything, but you know what you need to do. What you need is money. You have a land bank, but you have to figure out how you're going to capitalize that, and that you have scarce resources locally. Here's something that we can do to help you, and it's money that every other state is using. When a gas executive comes in to complain about or a Republican leader wants to complain about the severance tax, I say, well, you know, what is it about every other state that makes it okay there and not in Pennsylvania? So do you go to the governor of Texas and complain about the severance tax, which is three times as much as I'm proposing with the impact fee and the severance tax combined? And they say, well, no, we don't do it. You know, why is Pennsylvania the only state without that? Here's an opportunity for us. If we securitize that, we could gain $4.5 billion. That's with a B, and that would generate how much more money from local and private and federal funding? Maybe $10-15 billion, money that could be used to do things that local governments, local communities actually know they need. And instead of just sort of giving a mandate or another fresh idea from Harrisburg, here's money. You have the ideas. Here's something that would help you actually implement those things.
The Republicans who oppose this have said, you mentioned the impact fee. The impact fee was implemented to provide money to those areas of the state that whose infrastructure was impacted by natural gas drilling, roads, fire and police, that kind of thing. So Republicans will say that, or the Republicans who oppose this would say that, well, we already have an impact fee that brings in $200 million a year.
$190 million.
You're $10 million here or there, Governor, you know. I'll give you that $190 million a year, okay. But it's been $1.7 billion, according to the Republicans, since 2012 when it was implemented. And what they come back with is that you put a severance tax on top of that impact fee, you drive this business out of Pennsylvania, you lose those jobs.
And here's my counter to that. First of all, we ought to keep that $190 million. And what I'm talking about is in addition to that, and the combination has to be reasonable. This industry, I think, should succeed. This is a great opportunity for Pennsylvania in so many different ways. But that'd be $490 million total. And I think the impact fee is really important because, as you point out, it does go to areas that are directly affected by the drilling. But by comparison, Texas gets $1.4 billion a year from their natural gas industry in severance tax. Now, they're number one, we're number two, so you could argue they're bigger than us, but not that much bigger. So I'm proposing one-third of what Texas gets. You take $300 million out of that $490 million, and that could create the money that we could use to invest in things that Pennsylvania really needs. The question is, you know, we actually could make Pennsylvania a better place for the employees who work for those drillers, who work for those gas companies. We could make Pennsylvania a better place for their families to live, for them to live, and to go to school. Those are things that would make winners all across Pennsylvania, and I think it would cement the connection between Pennsylvania citizens and the gas industry. The final thing is, we have the gas here, but we also have the market. We are smack dab in the middle of the richest market in the world for the products that come out of this. And right now, there are all kinds of places around the world like Texas and Louisiana and Alberta and Canada where they have this natural resource, but they don't have the market. We have both here. We're unique in that regard. And so this is a place that this industry could do very, very, very well. And what I'm talking about is let's create some winners in Pennsylvania who really have an incentive to want to make this industry as successful as it could possibly be.
So what you're saying is those drillers aren't going anywhere since the gas is here.
Well, and the market is here. And the comparison with other states, I think if I were proposing something that was an outrageous severance tax, then I think that would be a legitimate argument. You're driving them away. But I'm doing nothing of the kind. And what I'm proposing is actually right in line with the impact fee, right in line with other states. In fact, lower than many of them. So I'm trying to be reasonable here and recognizing that you want to come into a state that doesn't tax you excessively, but you also don't want to come into a state where you can't get broadband or where you have flooding affecting you all the time. One of the things that I was appealing to some of the Texas gas company was at a seminar with one of them and said, you know, you folks argue a lot about natural gas. I said, yeah, we do. That's who we are in Pennsylvania. I said, but we don't have 125-mile-an-hour hurricanes like you do in Texas that wipe out your refineries and your companies. And I said, and that's saying something. And we're not thousands of miles from the richest market in the world either. We're right there. So we have a lot of advantages right here in Pennsylvania. There's a lot of reason why a company would want to be here, and a modest severance tax is not going to change that.
The Speaker of the House, Republican Mike Terzai, has a number of reasons that he opposes this. One of the things that Speaker Terzai has said, and other Republicans, is that those who work here in Pennsylvania, those who drill here in Pennsylvania, already pay taxes. Let's listen to what he had to say.
If we have good public policies, we can generate a $60 billion increase in Pennsylvania's GDP, support the addition of 100,000 new jobs, and potentially increase state revenues to the tune of billions. We already have corporate taxes. We already have personal income taxes. We have sales taxes.
We've heard that for a long time, that these people who are working in Pennsylvania pay income tax, that they pay sales tax when they're out buying products here in Pennsylvania. What about that?
Well, if he actually believes that, I wonder why he has not helped me. In every year, I have also proposed a reduction in the corporate net income tax, a dramatic drop. I eliminated the capital stock and franchise tax, first time that's happened since 1840. I recognize that Pennsylvania cannot put a sign up that says we're not in business, but a severance tax is not doing that. And the corporate net income tax that I think is too high, he has not been very helpful in helping me reduce that. I'm not sure what his plan is for bringing $60 billion more dollars into our gross state product, but I've been doing that, and I think part of that strategy, whatever it is, has to include investing in good schools that would make people want to come here to send their kids to school. It would have to mean investing in infrastructure to make sure that people who come here like the roads and bridges that we have. I think it would mean good environmental laws to make sure that we protect the great scenery that we have here in the open spaces. Those are the things that I think we need to do. And he and I obviously agree that we need to make Pennsylvania as attractive as possible. We need to do that in ways that means that we have to be reasonable in how we tax, but also that we're not scrimping on how we invest.
Republicans did come up with an alternative plan called Energize PA. Among other things, the 8 bills would make it easier for companies to get environmental permits, encourage development on abandoned industrial sites, and make it cheaper to run natural gas lines to businesses. I've heard you dismiss this case as that it's not really a plan.
Yeah, I don't and maybe I'm missing something, but it certainly doesn't raise $4.5 billion. My plan does include last mile pipes to actually make sure that there is an increased demand for the natural gas in terms of heating and things that people, commercial users, need when it comes to gas, getting them access to the natural gas. But I'm not sure how I'm not sure which plan you're referring to, but the one I'm familiar with also has drilling on state parks, which
state land, yeah,
the state land, which I'm against, and which seems to me that we have those state lands in reserve for people to enjoy without seeing drilling rigs and other things, to enjoy the natural rather than the built environment. So I don't understand why that is seen as an alternative to what I'm proposing. It's not even close.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program, Governor Tom Wolf. We're discussing his Restore Pennsylvania infrastructure plan. Governor, we've talked about a lot of what the opponents have said to this plan. I noticed on your website that there is a map of Pennsylvania, and there's little marks where officials, public officials, most of the mayors, have endorsed your plan. But when I look at it, I notice that they're almost all south of, say, Interstate 80, and very few in southwestern Pennsylvania where drilling is occurring. So it looks as though we have places where natural gas drilling is not occurring is where you have support for this. What about those areas where there's drilling?
Yeah, maybe I'm not explaining it as well as I should, but those areas above Route 80 are actually places that could use this the most, where broadband doesn't exist, where they're actually standing in their own shadow by not allowing businesses and schools, and they're not getting access to the health care that they ought to. And when autonomous vehicles become a reality, they're not going to be able to have those. Those are areas that are in desperate need of what I'm talking about here. So it's probably my fault for not explaining it as well as I should. And I think the other thing is that again, there's a fear that a state could go overboard in terms of taxing and really shut the industry down. We cannot afford to do that. And I certainly don't want to do that. I want to make this on top of the impact fee, because I think that is really something that's important for areas that are directly affected by the drilling. So I'm not sure why the area that I think would actually, some of the areas that could use this the most would be against this, probably that I haven't explained it well enough.
Well, I don't know about that, Governor. I think you know the answer is that they're afraid of losing those gas jobs. I mean, let me just give you an example. I spoke recently to a state legislator.
But
state
I don't want them to lose those gas jobs. So that's why I think it's probably that I have not explained it well enough. Because I think if they lose the gas jobs, then this is not a good plan.
Talk to a state representative from Greene County recently. Actually, we were talking about expansion of broadband. And she's a Democrat. And I asked her, would you support or do you support Governor Wolf's Restore Pennsylvania plan? And right away, she said, no, because I'm afraid of driving those gas jobs out. I want to expand broadband. It's one of my priorities. But I do not want to hurt those gas jobs.
Yeah, and I don't either. I don't want to hurt those gas jobs. Again, if I thought this would do that, I wouldn't be proposing it. I think that if you really think about, if you want to do a mind experiment, you know, could say I could have a society with no taxes, absolutely no money raised at all, but then we wouldn't have anything that would make life worth living, and we probably wouldn't have much in the way of economic development. We certainly wouldn't have business development, because you wouldn't have private property. So the question is, where do you strike that appropriate balance? And I understand and acknowledge that's something that we ought to be debating all the time, eternally. You know, what is the right balance? But to say that we need to attract people to Pennsylvania, but we're not going to pay for the things that might attract them here, strikes me as penny wise and dollar foolish.
As I mentioned earlier, all 5 years in office, you have proposed
a, four and a half.
Okay, well, five if we count. You made budget a budget address. I'll count it that way.
Okay.
All right. We won't do by calendar years.
Five budgets.
budgets. Right. Anyway, that you have proposed a severance tax, and Republicans have said no every time.
Right.
What's different this time?
Well, again, this time was the first time I did not propose it as part of the budget, and I purposely separated it from the budget, said, let's do this. I think it was a week before the budget address, actually, and said, let's take this money. Let's raise it. This is a dedicated tax, and it's dedicated to funding infrastructure investments at the local level that each of those local levels, those local communities actually need. In some areas, it's broadband. Some areas, it's flood mitigation. Some areas, it's blight. Some areas, it's lead, asbestos, and mold. Some areas, it's last mile gas into commercial development. Some areas, it's open space preservation. But whatever that is, it's not the idea they're lacking. It's the funding. And let's take this tax, and let's take this that every other state is doing. We're the only state without it. Let's take this that the Independent Fiscal Office says 80% of this would be paid for by non-Pennsylvanians, because it gets embedded in the cost of the stuff that we send to all these different places. Canadians would pay for this, and Europeans, and Texans, and Louisianans, whoever. They would help to pay for our schools and our roads and our bridges and things that would make Pennsylvania a better place to live. So I think what's different is I'm tying this to a specific outcome that, again, you can maybe disagree with the way I'm raising it or the rate that I want to charge, but I'm trying to be reasonable here, and there has to be I think there's almost universal acknowledgement that the things that I want to invest this money in are things that we really need.
And as I said earlier, I think that everyone would agree that we are in need of modernizing and upgrading our infrastructure. As you're thinking about that, this is certainly an ambitious plan because, I mean, we've just touched on the surface.
$4.5 billion, yes, that's a very ambitious plan.
But not just tying to the money, but the number of projects that you're looking
Absolutely.
At. You've talked about several of them. But you've been around the state, some have said campaign style, talking about this
yeah.
plan. In your 4.5 years, I don't know if I can remember you being as enthusiastic or being out there on an issue like this.
I think I was as enthusiastic about education because I think that's something that the state really has to invest in. And I'm enthusiastic about things I'm a native Pennsylvanian. I think we have an amazing state here, and I want other people to recognize that. But they're not going to recognize it if it isn't so. And so I think we can't say to workers all around the world, Pennsylvania is the place you want to come and build a career when we have a $7.25 minimum wage. That's just a sticker shock. We can't say to entrepreneurs who I want Pennsylvania to be a magnet for people who are going to come and create good jobs and opportunities. We can't say we're open for business when we have a 9.99% corporate net income tax. We can't say to anybody out there that, you know, this is a place that is just really, you know, the quality of life is wonderful. We don't have non-discrimination legislation that you can still be fired for marching in a pride parade. Those are the kinds of things that I think we have got to look at. And I've been, I think, exuberant about pushing those things. I'm exuberant about this because I think this is a good idea, too. Again, it comes back to making my state better.
You realize, of course, you did sound like you were campaigning when you just listed those things.
I'm not running for anything.
Well, you're in your last term anyway.
Yes, I am.
As governor of Pennsylvania.
Yes.
You know, we haven't really touched, I mean, we've touched on them but talked about specifics. Of all these projects that are part of the plan, is there one that you think is more important or more critical?
You mean in Restore Pennsylvania?
Yes.
No, and that's the thing. I'm from York, so there might be some things in York that are really important. But if I lived up in Bradford County, I probably would be thinking broadband. But if I lived in certain communities in Bradford County, I might be thinking flood control or mitigation. So the beauty of this is that it is something that says this is not one size fits all. This is tailored to different needs in different areas. The only thing that is common in all those areas is the need for money. And that's why I call this. This is a funded non-mandate. This is something that you know you need. You have the best idea for this. What you don't have is the funding. And usually it's areas that need the most work and need the most funding that have the fewest resources to do it. They have great ideas, but no resources. So this is something that I think is important. So again, if I lived up in the northern tier, I think the broadband is really important. If I were a farmer, I'd want broadband and lived in a rural area. If I lived in a city, I think the blight, open space preservation, and flood mitigation would be important. But it depends on where you're from and what the key issue is there. The beauty of this is it can address each and every one of those needs.
And timing as well. All this week, much of Pennsylvania has been under a flood watch because it's rained every day. And over the past year, we've set records for rain. I don't know if a lot of people realize, and I'm not making your case for you, I'm just stating fact, is that Pennsylvania is the most flood-prone state in the country. Reason I bring that out is because when people think of infrastructure, often they think of transportation and not of sewer, not of water, not of lead and all these things. So that's why when I said that this is an ambitious plan, that it is covering a lot of area. But I do want to get back to broadband because this is something that you hear around the state, but especially in rural areas, about why it is so important. Why is it so important?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I cite five, but let's start with transportation. If you want autonomous vehicles, which apparently people are saying that's the future, you need GPS. Well, you can't have GPS if you don't have broadband. You can't say, okay, here's an autonomous vehicle. It works in southern Pennsylvania, but you're going to the northern tier. Sorry, you can't use it. Well, guess what? People with autonomous vehicles are going to choose not to live there. You can't have schools that actually increasingly rely on elements of distance learning, assignments that go out over the net. The Senate was talking about cyber snow days so that you wouldn't actually have to show up at school because you could do things from home remotely. You can't do that if you don't have broadband. So in the education system, we're denying access to all those students, access to the world, access to all the things we need them to have access to if they're going to cure the disease that we want them to cure or come up with a killer app that they could come up with. They're not going to be able to do that if we have not given them an equal access to the world. Farmers aren't going to be able to do their work, manage their supply chains if they don't have access to the internet. Businesses are not going to be able to grow. Rural health is going to be completely impossible if we can't connect homes to hospitals throughout the Commonwealth. There's just a lot of reasons why this is important, but it comes down to consigning people in Pennsylvania to living a life not in the 21st century. That's not only unfair to them, it's unfair to the rest of us. Mm.
Governor, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. So where do you think this goes? I mean, again, Republicans already said it's not tied to the budget, but the Republicans have already said it's a non-starter.
Well, I think they've said we're not going to get it in June because we're focused on the budget. Often when they say we're going to get to it in the fall, that's just sort of pushing it off into Never Never Land. But I think this time it is something that we're all going to come back to in the fall. And that's what I'm hoping that we do, because we can afford to wait 2 months. We've waited years for this. And I've been going out. You mentioned the flooding right now. Pennsylvania is flood prone. It's not just this year. It's every year I've been here. And two more months to consider how we do this and make sure we're doing it right, I think, is fine with me. But this is the magnitude that we're talking about. Whatever we do, this is the kind of investment we're going to need to make Pennsylvania everything that we need it to be.
Is there a plan B?
I don't have one. I haven't seen one.
Is that wise?
When you're talking about $4.5 billion, there's just very few ways that you can do that in a way that's going to be palatable. There might be something else that might come up, and maybe we could coalesce around. As I say, the nice thing about this is there seems to be broad agreement that we need to make major investments, and as you acknowledge, major investment in our infrastructure and making Pennsylvania better. The question is, you know, where can we come up with that funding? I think, you know, this is my proposal. If there's an alternative out there, I'm willing to have a robust conversation about it.
Governor Tom Wolf, thank you very much for being on Smart Talk today.
Thank you. It's been great being with you, Scott.
And check out some upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/smarttalk. You can see some of the shows that we're working on, such as Women's Suffrage, the 100th anniversary. And we also, in conjunction with that, we'll talk about women who are getting more involved in running for elective office. Also, eating disorders and charter schools, specifically cyber charter schools. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving a voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. If you are one of the nearly 40 million people in the U.S. who experience migraine headaches, you know how debilitating they are. Migraine is much more than just a bad headache, treated with over-the-counter pain medicine. For many people, migraine is a chronic disease that significantly diminishes their quality of life. Joining us to talk about migraine today, Dr. Stephen Ross, professor of neurology at Penn State University's College of Medicine at Hershey. Dr. Ross, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for the invitation.
Also joining us is Nim Lavani, director of the American Migraine Foundation. Ms. Lavani, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment about one-third of the population suffering from migraines, we'd like to hear from you today. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Nim Lavani, let me start with you. June is actually Migraine Headache Awareness Month. What do Americans, what does the public need to be aware of?
Yes, June is Migraine Headache and Awareness Month, and the entire month starting June 1st through June 30th is focused on various advocacy days and efforts to highlight the debilitating nature of migraine. What people really need to understand about migraine and what advocacy organizations across the country are focused on this month is to really highlight that migraine is a stigmatized chronic illness. People degrade it as just a headache. They believe that it's something that people are making up to shirk work or their responsibilities. And so mostly the awareness around MHAM is to focus on the debilitating nature of migraine, the symptoms associated with it, and why it should be taken more seriously as a chronic illness.
When you say that there's a stigma attached to it, and you gave the example of those who suffer from migraines, that many people look at them as they're shirking their jobs or their work or something like that, maybe it would be wise if we told just exactly what is a migraine.
Absolutely. So migraine is a headache disorder that's associated with various symptoms, and for some, it could be with aura or without aura. And aura is the visual symptoms that are associated with the migraine. So sometimes individuals with migraine have an aura that's zigzagged lines. Part of their vision is blurred. Various different visual disturbances. But migraine doesn't just end there. It's usually associated with severe pain on one side of the head. There are symptoms like nausea, vomiting, sound sensitivity, light sensitivity, smell sensitivities. Sometimes foods can trigger migraine in individuals, or sometimes stress. There's a whole host of symptoms and triggers that can bring on a migraine, and it can last anywhere from a few hours to many days. In fact, one of our main advocates this month for MHAM is a 12-year-old in Pennsylvania. She lives in Wayne, and she's currently in the middle of a 110-day migraine attack. So as you can see, it's a spectrum disorder. It's a spectrum disease. It can take on many unique forms. Even within one person and one individual, their symptoms can vary from attack to attack and month to month.
Dr. Ross, you saw me raise my eyebrows when I heard 112 days or 110 days. I never knew. I mean, probably most people don't know. They're thinking, okay, if you have a migraine, it lasts for a few hours and that's it. That's not the case?
Unfortunately not. For many people, it goes on for days, but it's estimated about 1 in 20 people who suffer from migraine. It's going to go on for multiple days, and I've seen individuals where it's gone on for a year or more.
With that much pain?
Yes.
How can anyone operate their own lives? How can they function with a situation like that?
That's the challenge, is they really can't. And people go about their activities day in and day out, but they really can't function fully. They miss days at work or they miss days at school. They can't interact with family. They miss birthday parties. It really is a life changer for people.
Why is there this stigma?
I think there's a lack of awareness of what it really means. I think she hit on it correctly. A lot of people, when they hear the word migraine, they think just headache. And I've had a headache, and what's the big deal? I take a Tylenol, and it's gone. But I like to describe migraine as something I've read in old literature, an electrical storm of the brain. So basically, it affects multiple parts of the brain, and it can slow you down. Your thinking is slowed down. Your talking is slowed down. Your walking is slowed down. You're upset at your stomach. You don't want to do anything. So it really is debilitating.
Mm. So we talked about aura. What about trigger? Are migraines triggered by any one thing, like weather, for example?
So they can be. It depends on the individual. Most individuals that I've talked with have more than one trigger. There are some individuals who haven't identified any, but weather is a common trigger. Food is another trigger. Stress is another trigger. Hormones is another trigger. And in the individual, you're trying to help them figure out what are the triggers for them so they can try to avoid those triggers.
That was my next question. And Nim, you can join in this part of the conversation too. Is that something that those who suffer from migraines that they are taught to do or taught to recognize what their triggers are and avoid those?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a patient myself. I'm living with a type of migraine called hemiplegic migraine. And that categorization of migraine usually presents in a way that makes it look like that I'm having a stroke. So one side of my body is paralyzed. I have speech and speech impediment, when I first was diagnosed with migraine, they thought I was having a stroke or that I had epilepsy because I was having seizure-like symptoms. That was when I was 18 years old. It's almost 20 years later, and I've learned over the course of those 20 years that there are certain triggers that I need to be aware of. For me, it's my sleep schedule. It's weather, which I can't control, but at least I can sort of predict and sort of identify ways to hopefully decline the onset of a migraine attack. Usually I'm not successful there because of the weather is so intense lately in Pennsylvania. However, lifestyle changes are very important. I've incorporated yoga. I've incorporated meditation. I've looked at my diet. In fact, at the American Migraine Foundation, we have the experts from the American Headache Society who are focused on nutrition, diet, and all of the other lifestyle recommendations to write specific tools, resources, and guides for patients that are trying to understand their triggers.
What
is a major factor?
When you say that weather can be a trigger for you, what kind of weather?
Particularly what we've been having for the last few weeks, these very humid storm fronts that are coming in with the rain and the clouds and sudden onset and change in weather is certainly a main trigger for me. Travel and change in elevation is a secondary trigger, sort of related to one another. But over time, for me at least, I've learned those triggers and learned how to adjust, or at least learn how to predict. It's not something that's a perfect science. It never will be, in my opinion, because it's such a unique experience for every individual, and as I mentioned earlier, from one attack to another.
So one of the big questions, of course, Dr. Ross, then, is treatment. We're talking about, is it correct terminology to refer to migraines as a disease?
I believe it is, yes.
Okay. So what kind of medication, what kind of treatment is there for this disease?
Fortunately, today in 2019, we have many different types of treatments, unlike some past years. In my own experience, I tend to tailor the treatment to the individual's personal desire. There are some people who really don't want medication. There are a lot of good medicines, a lot of new medicines, but some people don't like taking medicines. And in those individuals, there's a lot of options these days for non-medical treatment for migraine. Just within the past year or so, there's also medical devices the FDA has approved. I saw a report just yesterday, the FDA has approved a new app on an iPhone that people can use. So there's lots of new things coming out that can be ranging from prescribed to things that you can do on your own.
Okay, app on an iPhone, what can
you strap it to your arm and it gives a pulse that comes out when your migraine starts, and supposedly that will reduce the migraine. I don't have the original data on it. It was just a news flash yesterday that caught my eye. So people are constantly looking for new things.
Would you prescribe that or would you want to see more information?
I'd want to see more information.
I had a feeling you would say that. Let's take a phone call from Susan in Lancaster. Susan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Scott. This is very close to my heart because my life has been defined by migraines since the time I was like about 4 years old, running high temperatures with tonsillitis, to now that I'm 67. And I want to mention that I can remember my father coming home from work and going right to bed. And now my son, being a mom, I'm always concerned about my son. He runs them with the weather changes. So there's a hereditary element involved. But I want to say one thing that's really important to me, and it dovetails with this opioid crisis. I have very good insurance. And over the years, I have found a medication that works. It's one of the triptans. My insurance company would love to cover unlimitedly an opioid painkiller for me with my migraines with, you know, any time I want. I don't want to take that. It's, you know how what they do to you. The triptan, however, has such a limited amount, and if anybody has migraines and has a medication that absolutely works wonderfully, it's like a miracle drug to me, one of the triptans that I take. Anybody with a migraine knows that if they're limited with the actual material that works, it actually produces more anxiety, which is one of the elements that brings one a migraine. So that's an interesting aspect of the treatment, because I don't want to take one of those daily things, you know, the anti-convulsive things every single day when you don't need it, because my triptan is as needed. And the only other thing I want to mention very quickly is I think women have had a really hard time being branded with the condition because there's an element of menstrual migraine. And for years, I dealt with that on top of weather and anything else. So I think there's all kinds of complexities involved with having a migraine, and it's a horrible, horrible thing to have to deal with. It limits your life.
Susan, thankfully, thank you very much.
I'm better now.
Dr. Ross, you brought up several topics here, but first of all, what are triptans?
So these are prescription medications that have been out for more than 20 years, and you take them. It's like a Tylenol or an ibuprofen. You feel the migraine coming on, you take it as needed.
Prescription?
Prescription. For many in the U.S., in some European countries, they're over-the-counter. But for many people, they will help stop the attack.
She did mention opioids, though.
Correct.
Is that a medication, opioid-related, is that a medication that can be prescribed sometimes?
So opioids can be prescribed. It's discouraged, but in a very select population of people who aren't allowed to have triptans and medications like that, sometimes opioids are necessary, but in a very select population.
Let me ask you quickly before I turn to Nim on the second part of that. Are there over-the-counter medications that are effective?
Yes, there are.
Like what?
Ibuprofen and Excedrin, Tylenol. There are some individuals who that's effective. And if I see a patient in the office and they tell me that that's effective, there's no reason to go to prescription medication. It's always important to go a little deeper. When you say effective, what do you mean? Because I've had some people tell me I'll take 4 ibuprofen and go to bed for 4 hours, and it helps. Well, it might have gotten better anyway from sleeping. So you really want to dig into what do you mean when you say it helps. But if it works, you don't need to go to prescription.
Nim Lavani, when she said that she thinks that, in so many words, she was saying that there's more of a stigma toward women with migraine. Is there any kind of research or breakdown on whether women suffer from migraine more often than men?
Oh, absolutely. I have the numbers for you. We have 1 in 5 women are the numbers in the United States who are living with migraine, 1 in 16 men, 1 in 11 children, and 1 in 4 households. But if you compound those numbers outside of the United States, you're looking at 1 billion worldwide who are living with migraine. And so the stigma associated with migraine around women particularly comes with the idea of the headache. It's a headache. It's women over time have been criticized about talking about having a headache and needing to lay down, and that got combined with this with migraine, and migraine is a disabling disease. But at the time and historically, nobody really understood migraine as a separate disorder or a separate headache disorder, and so it became dismissed, and that contributed to that larger stigma, not only around women but the disease itself. There's internalized stigma that an individual may feel. There is the institutional stigma from employers and universities and school systems. And then there is the social stigma that even family members who may become frustrated with an individual who's constantly canceling or saying, I need to go lay down or I can't make dinner for the third time this week. There's a lot of stigma associated because by nature, living with migraine is unpredictable. And what Dr. Ross was talking about in digging deeper, you know, providers and organizations like the American Migraine Foundation are encouraging individuals to keep a headache diary. There are mobile apps. There's traditional notebooks. There's templates you can download from online. You can track your symptoms, look at your triggers, and this will help your provider understand what you're really experiencing, what potential triggers you may have, or what lifestyle changes you may need to adjust in order to live a more normal or close to normal life when living with migraine.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health. Online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. We're talking about migraines, migraine headaches. And actually, as you've heard, it's a chronic disease for many people. June is Migraine Awareness Month. We're talking about a lot of different aspects of migraines with our guest today, Nim Lavani, Director of the American Migraine Foundation, and Dr. Stephen Ross, professor of neurology at Penn State University College of Medicine. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. We have an email from Kristen. It says, I've had migraines since the age 8. My mother and grandfather get them as well. My migraines were fairly well controlled until my second pregnancy, and I couldn't take Relpax that had worked for me before. My family doctor said he had seen some research that vitamin D deficiency could cause migraines, so he suggested I take a vitamin D supplement. This has significantly reduced the frequency of my migraines. I'm still taking it because with breastfeeding, I can't really take medication. Have your guest heard about vitamin D for prevention of migraines? Two questions there, Dr. Ross. First of all, and someone else mentioned this earlier, she talked about her mother and her grandfather having migraines. Is this hereditary?
It's definitely hereditary. About three-fourths of individuals who have migraine will have a first-degree relative with migraine. So there is a genetic component to it, no question, but also environmental. So the environment acts on your genes. And the idea of certain supplements assisting is well established. Probably the most data is with vitamin B2, but magnesium. There's a variety of vitamins that have shown benefit.
Let's take a phone call from Mitch in Chambersburg. Mitch, you're on the air. Hello, Mitch. Okay, actually, I think one Mitch wanted to talk about, he said herbal treatments work much better for him, and his doctor explained to him herbal treatments?
Yes, that would be the same line of what
okay,
I'm just,
that's
I
kind
of put
maybe
those
that's
all
why,
together. Yes.
Maybe that's why Mitch hung up there, that because he did hear your answer. Okay, so Nim Lavani, we have just about 3 minutes left. What do you want our audience to know during this Awareness Month?
That's a really good question. Personally, as a patient, I want them to know that they're not alone, that as an experience of living with migraine, it can feel isolating. There's a community for you through the American Migraine Foundation. Follow us on Facebook. Join our private community where you can connect with 20,000 other individuals. And if you're local to Pennsylvania and you want to contribute to research, take a look at our registry at the Jefferson Headache Center and start contributing your data to the research registry called ARMOR.
Dr. Ross, how closely do you follow the research? I mean, just by our conversation here the last 20 minutes, it sounds as if there are, I don't know, some positive things going on all the time.
So follow up very closely, and quite honestly, nowadays with internet and social media, patients follow up very closely as well. And often they're picking up things as quick as I pick up things. And sometimes they'll come in and I'll go do the research for something they found. But yes, this is a great time for migraine in that we have lots of new treatments coming out.
Is that a good thing, though, that, I mean, I've talked to many physicians over the years that, yes, everyone will go to WebMD or something very close to that and say, well, here's what I have and here's what I think it is. They diagnose themselves. Is it a good thing, though, that they have that access?
It can be a challenge, but I personally do think it's a good thing. I think it just has to be a conversation between the doctor and the person suffering with this. But yes, I view it as a positive.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you, Dr. Ross. The American Migraine Foundation has the Move Against Migraine campaign, and one of the themes is Start the Conversation, where we encourage tools on our website to have patients write down and start the conversation with their provider. And I think that and intellectual capability to speak with your provider is a super important one.
And, you know, what you just said, Nim, I think, and you two tell me, but any kind of medical condition or time, your health, it's probably a good idea to keep, I don't know if a diary is the right word or not, but to help your physician by keeping track of it. But it sounds as if this is especially helpful with migraine.
I agree. More so in individuals early in the course of it. If you've had it for 40 years and you already know your patterns, then I don't know that it's as needed that you keep a minute calendar. But early on, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So again, we only have about 40 seconds left. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Dr. Stephen Ross, professor of neurology at Penn State University College of Medicine in Hershey. Nim Lavani, director of the American Migraine Foundation. We will have a link to your website, Nim Lavani, on our website, witf.org, so that our listeners can learn more. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Monday, Monday is the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote here in the United States. So we'll be talking about that history of women's suffrage. But also, as part of that, we'll transition into a discussion about more women getting involved in politics and running for elective office. We saw that last year on the national level and also here on the state level here in Pennsylvania. That's coming up on Monday's show, so be sure to tune in. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great weekend.